Welcome to the Digiday podcast. I'm Tim Peterson, senior media editor at Digiday. Today, I'm talking with Sam Reich from College Humor. College Humor has been around for more than two decades, originally launching in 1999 as a comedy site. Sam joined College Humor in 2006 to build its original video business. Since then, College Humor was acquired by IAC, became one of the most successful video publishers on YouTube, produced shows for TV like Adam Ruins Everything, and launched a subscription-based streaming service, Dropout. But as my colleague Max Willens detailed in an article earlier this year, ultimately College Humor succeeded on the content side but struggled on the business side. In January, IAC decided it was no longer willing to finance College Humor and laid off more than 100 of its employees, but sold the business to Sam, who's been running the show ever since. Welcome, Sam. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. So, as I mentioned, you bought College Humor in January, and at that time you tweeted, you had a whole tweet thread, but you tweeted that in the next 6 months you hope to save College Humor. College Humor is obviously still around. You're still uploading videos, doing shows like Game Changer. So to paraphrase Taylor Swift, are you out of the woods yet?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, the timeline was actually that we were obligated to announce that I was taking over the company in January when IAC more or less, you know, shut everything down. But I didn't actually take it over until March. I signed my deal with IAC on a Tuesday and we went into quarantine on a Thursday. So suffice to say, it hasn't been the first year I imagined it would be. I guess the crib notes are, you know, the bad news is all around us, as it were. The good news is that we're stable. So, you know, I can say now after having been doing this for, gosh, what, nine-ish months now, that, you know, we have a stable foundation below us. We know we're going to be able to support a small team as well as most of the shows that our audience cares about. And I think the question that we're still obligated to answer is both how do we grow from here and also what's the vision for that growth? You know, in taking over the company, it wasn't my objective to try to make us a 100-plus person company again. I have to figure out what really what I want this company to be.
What are you thinking you want the company to be? Because, I mean, you got a company that's been pretty established. So I imagine you could just say, okay, we'll just keep going with what we got.
Yeah. I mean, look, the reason why I love digital and the reason why, despite now also having a foot in TV, I keep getting lured back into digital is because I love the promise of it. I love the idea of direct to audience and the sort of type of content one can create when one is going direct to audience. And I'd like to run a company where, you know, we can support any number of unlikely shows. Even if those shows are, you know, less expensive, certainly less traditional than you would see from Hollywood, and support them in any number of ways. I mean, I think one of the advantages we have in digital too is we're everything. So we're running merch, we're running ad sales, we're running subscription, and the combination of all of those business models supports our shows. You know, a very miniature version of a Hollywood studio, right? Mm-hmm. And so if I can continue to, you know, use those monetization tactics in order to do non-traditional programming for the rest of my life, that'd be great. I mean, I love it. I think the internet can be a tool that we use to move the medium forward. Without sounding too pretentious, the entertainment medium. I mean, we should be doing stuff that's less likely. We should be doing stuff that's like outside the box. We should be doing stuff that's non-traditional. And the more money you pour into something, arguably the more traditional it needs to become, because there's financial risk to offset. So if we can do stuff cheaply and scrappily and experimentally, that's kind of where I want to be.
So on that front, like, what have been the changes that you've made since acquiring College Humor? How is College Humor different today than it was a year ago this time when it was part of IAC?
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, you know, we were 105 people. Now we're seven and a half with a
How do you have a half person?
Okay. So Natalie Maeslick, who is CFO at IAC, has remained on board as like a consultant for us, and she's brilliant. So we're very grateful. We're all working from home. That's more of, to do with the pandemic than anything else. But we've been forced to answer that question, you know, how do we continue to produce cost-effective content in this way? I think from a business perspective, the biggest difference, you know, quite apart from the lifestyle difference, right? Like what it means to run a small company, what it means to work remotely, is... IAC, for better or for worse, was always engaged in the kind of like meta exercise of trying to make us a company that was worth a lot of money. There's a big difference between, you know, running a company and saying, how are we going to create an asset that's worth $250 million? And what we're doing now, which is really like, how do we make enough money to keep the lights on and create programming that we love? So we're, taking a lot less risks than I think IAC did. You know, Dropout, the subscription service, was in and of itself a huge risk, but that, prudent decision-making and, is, I think, lending itself to some more like careful, and strong strategic bets.
Because you still have the subscription service, so you have that subscription revenue coming in. Is that basically serving as your baseline for your operating to cover your operating costs right now?
Precisely. I mean, at first it was it, right? Like if not for subscription, if not for Dropout, I don't think we would have done this. Partially because it's just like the best model out there. You know, like if you have guaranteed revenue coming in from fans, from people who are passionate about your business, that beats remnant ads on social media where the CPMs can swing all over the place. That beats, one-off advertising deals. That beats Hollywood where it's really like the network telling you, you have permission to create or not to create. So yeah, that's the baseline. And then, there's also like the remnant ad inventory that we make on YouTube, Facebook, other AVOD platforms. There's a little bit of ad sales we're still doing this year, although without an ad sales team, not a ton.
It gets difficult without a sales team.
Yeah, it's literally just, you know, us executives like responding to a few RFPs. Okay. The goal this year was to figure out, like, can we survive? And we can, you know? So now it's like, where do we go from here?
Got it. So is College Humor profitable today?
It is. This is actually its first profitable year in, I believe, at least like 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
Now, it needed to be because we've structured the incentives of the team such that we really only make money if it is profitable.
Okay.
But I should say, you know, profitable is that funny term where like IAC probably could have made it profitable. But didn't, like, wanted to invest in it, wanted to make it bigger. It's just a kind of a cruel irony in a way that by doing that, they were setting us up to be profitable as a much smaller company.
Right. And so, like, looking to 2021, like, profitable now, are you looking to keep it profitable just as a measure of, okay, this is a way that if we can keep profitable, then we know this is sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, again, it needs to be, because if it's not profitable, like we as a core team are incentivized.
Okay. Because you haven't taken on outside funding, have you?
We haven't, no. No. It doesn't need to be crazy profitable, and it's not crazy profitable, right? Like, at a certain point, we'd love to be able to invest more money back into the company. Specifically, I think, to prepare for the future, to create more shows, to invest in more talent. I mean, those are the things College Humor arguably always did the best was, you know, we were good at identifying really funny up-and-coming people out there who, you know, represented this kind of like new voice, like youngest, but nonetheless professional voice in comedy, and then gave them the opportunity to create non-traditional shows. And I want to do that. I want to continue to do that. I think we're under this funny kind of obligation now where we have to like prove the business model and prove that that's possible before we take on too much risk. So what that lends itself to is investing in our existing IP, the stuff that we know the audience is going to gravitate to, and then doing like a little bit of experimenting on our own, you know, like, can this platform really support short form animation? For instance, is that something that the users are going to respond to? And then if they do, it opens up this opportunity for us to approach talent on the outside and really build out that offering.
Right. And animation seems like a prudent move in 2020, just with the pandemic. Obviously, you know, harder to do physical production. So a lot of folks have shifted to animation because, I mean, you can do that remotely a lot easier than you can do other types of production remotely. You have Troopers, which is kind of like a Star Wars send up, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
How's the short form animation gone over?
Yeah, it seems to be doing well. I mean, I think two things surprised us on subscription, like throughout the last year. The first is the audience there is on subscription for short form content. I think in our minds, it was always like people are going to subscribe for long form content because short form content is what we already offer for free. And what we learned is kind of like, no, the subscribing audience doesn't necessarily make that distinction. And I think the second is just how powerful and in a way, like, underserved the adult animation audience is. Like, you would imagine, well, there's so much high-quality adult animation out there. But it compared to some other stuff, right? Like, if we were to get into, I don't know, sports. Let's use something I know nothing about.
Fantastic.
There's not nearly as much like adult animation content as there is sports content out there. And so actually that our audience would probably say they're underserved. They want more. That's something that we can offer. But Troopers is a great, for instance. So we had this IP, arguably our IP, right? It began as a Star Wars parody series, but kind of its own world, took on its own life. The characters took on their own life. The fans at one point built out a wiki for it. It's very distinct from the world of Star Wars. And we did a live action reboot for Dropout. And then as we were discussing what would we invest in short form animation, we were like, well, we should give Troopers a try in animation. That makes a ton of sense. They don't even have mouths. How cost efficient is that? They're wearing helmets. But what that experiment was, you know, me calling trusted animation partner Lowbrow Mike Parker and saying, how do we do this cost effectively as a first step? And then who wrote it? My wife and I, because this is a very intimate, humble operation. Who does the voices? Me, my best friend in the world, Josh Rubin, and Luke Scholl, the original voice of Dreadlord, also very close to the family. So, you know, can we do these little like humble experiments? Can they snowball? And can we use that to open the door to more? Okay. That's kind of the tack now.
You buried something interesting and surprising in there where you said people are willing to pay for short form shows.
Yeah.
I feel like history at this point is littered with examples that would be to the contrary. Like, we just had Quibi shut down. Obviously, Go 90 didn't work out. Full Screen was kind of short form, but they were like doing other things. But there are just all these examples of short form subscription services not panning out. What is it that you're seeing at College Humor? People are paying specifically for the short form shows, or you're seeing?
It's a really good question, and I wish that I could like come to you with some grand thesis about subscription as it relates to our industry, especially after stuff like Quibi failed. I can only speak from our experience and say at every stage of the game, it's been surprising what people have come into Dropout for and what they've stayed for. So when we began, it was with what we thought was a really mature thesis for like how to run a subscription business. We were like, we're going to have our acquisition content and our retention content. Acquisition content is going to be bigger, splashier, scripted, premium, because that's what people pay for. That's what people pay for on Netflix. That's what people pay for on Amazon, that premium feel. And then we're going to have the retention content, which is going to be longer form, less expensive, slightly more like personality led. That seems like it would make sense too. Then what happened was the retention content did both and the acquisition content did neither.
Oh, wow.
In other words, the most expensive content was less effective in getting people in or keeping them there than the less expensive content. And if that hadn't been the case, I don't know that we would have done this. I don't know that we would have taken over the company. But we saw this opportunity to right-size it. Like we saw, okay, you know, if the expensive content isn't moving the needle, maybe that opens up a window for us to do a less expensive version of this. And it's that pitch that we made around town to try to sell College Humor. And it's only when like no one took us up on that offer that I went, you know what? I think I believe enough in this to try to do it myself. So the second surprise after premium versus less premium was short form versus long form. One of our most popular series on the platform is a You Laugh, You Lose concept called Breaking News, where basically we put four comedians on a stage. They're anchors of a news broadcast, and they're reading teleprompters that they've never read before. They don't know what, you know, text is coming next, what lines are coming next. And if they laugh, they lose points. It's a relatively short form show. It's like, you know, 5 minutes-ish per episode. And it's super popular on the platform. And it brings people into the platform from AVOD. Also, the College Humor Library is free already on YouTube and is a, you know, not insignificant portion of what people consume on Dropout, as if to suggest that like, you know, just having that content high quality in a place that's well organized is enough to get them consuming it. So it's, yeah, it's like, it's been a wild...
I mean, it's 2020, so I guess this isn't surprising, but it sounds like you're going against all of the conventional wisdom of a subscription-based streaming service in 2020.
Sure, sure. Which I guess like I'm proud of at the same time is like I can take no responsibility for it. It's just the behavior of the users, you know?
Right.
I mean, you know, Dimension 20, which is our RPG actual play show. You know, Dungeons and Dragons, if you will, although our particular take on it is kind of like very left of center, is like we went into that show really not knowing how it would perform next to other subscription content, because episodes, single episodes of that show were like 90 minutes long. And right out of the gate, it was one of our most popular shows. And today it's one of our most popular shows. Every single episode is, you know, a group of incredibly talented, funny, improvised comedians sitting around a table playing an engaging game of D&D, you know?
Okay.
Netflix would and could never do something like that,
right?
You know?
So, I mean, when you can do programming where like, you can throw a bunch of things at the wall and things stick, but then also things that land on the ceiling stick, things that land on the floor stick. Like, how do you kind of manage, okay, what, especially like the way that you're operating this business where you're trying to be as financially responsible as possible? How do you do this in a way where it's, okay, we can invest more in this show, or this should be the next thing we look to develop, when it seems like it's what's working is kind of all over the place?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that there is the creatively liberated answer to that question, which is who knows? So let's try to make stuff that really excites us and then just see if anyone else gets aboard, which is, you know, I think the right brain side of me would love to be the answer, and kind of is the answer in the sense of nowadays we're investing in stuff that like excites us and we think is good. It's not squarely the answer. Like Dropout's sort of voice, and I think, which is dictated heavily not only by the tastes of College Humor talent of the past, but also just my personal proclivities, is like tends to be high concept, a little satirical, a little surreal, a little experimental. I like to say I think we're kind of more accessible, more inclusive Adult Swim. Like if Adult Swim is trying to push you away, we're kind of trying to invite you in a little bit more. Certainly, you know, there is this conventional logic in programming, which is if you have a show that's popular, you build out more programming in concentric circles to that content. I'm sure you've heard that before.
What's our cinematic universe?
Yeah, more or less. So it's like, hey, if, you know, D&D is popular on your platform, you know, what other shows can you do in the world of RPG or games or gaming or actual play? I mean, two of our most popular shows right now, apart from the D&D actual play show, are game shows, which again is like people are paying for game shows. Yep. Never would have guessed that to be the case. But certainly, you know, toward the end of, I guess, 2019, it was like, well, with Dimension 20 being popular and I'm actually popular, is there a show that we could do that's almost more akin to a traditional game show, but is our spin on it? And that's how Game Changer was formed. And Game Changer really worked. I mean, out of the gate, people were all in. Animation, like we've been talking about. I think somewhere where I'm eager to experiment that we haven't done, we had this one early successful experiment, which was an animated show called WTF 101, or What the Blank 101.
You can say and, I'm pretty sure.
And it was kind of like our answer to the Magic School Bus, all grown up and about all of the messed up things in our world. And, you know, vis-a-vis one-offs we did back in the day, Adam Ruins Everything, which, you know, we produced in-house and then took to market with Adam. WTF 101, there is this like through line of like adult education in College Humor. I'd like to do more of that. I think we're going to experiment with more of that as time goes on. So certainly building out in like interest sectors that we see and trying to like, you know, feed audience from one show into another show. But then I'd be lying if I didn't say sometimes we just go for it because we're excited about something.
Got it. And with that, like, how are you managing the business and programming between Dropout, the subscription service, and then YouTube and Facebook, and what you make available to for free, what goes behind the paywall, basically?
Yeah. I think it's almost easier to talk about YouTube in that context because Facebook is such a bizarre platform for content right now. Yeah. Just in the sense of like, I feel like people consume content on Facebook in a way that's like not at all similar to any other platform. Facebook has no memory. So we can post a video, you know, on Facebook from 2015 and people will watch it as if it's new. And then we'll post the same video again 3 months later and people will watch it as if it's new. It's almost like programming a magazine, you know, versus programming like a content catalog. YouTube has a terrific memory, so we can't do that, right? And YouTube is tricky because... well, for a few reasons, but as far as it relates to Dropout, we want to give people a window shopping experience into our content. We want them to watch it and like it and decide that they're going to subscribe to Dropout to support us, if not to like watch the rest of the show or more of the show. Hmm. but we don't want to give so much away that it undermines the dropout proposition value. And that balance is tricky. And I think we're, you know, right now, two of our popular shows, actually, and Dimension 20, have their own YouTube channels. And what we're doing is posting content there that at this point is about a year old. And in our minds, if a full year has gone by, any dropout subscriber is going to feel like, you know, yeah, I'm not going to wait a year for this show. I'm a fan of this show. Even if some more of it's available for free on AVOD, you know, this balance makes sense to me. But meanwhile, Rooster Teeth has some shows that post like the next day or like 3 days later to YouTube and seems to be like successfully running their business that way.
Weren't you all doing that with Dropout at one point?
Not that close a window.
Okay. No, I mean, I thought there was like a 3 day window. Maybe I'm misremembering, maybe I'm misattributing.
So with sketches, with like the one-offs that we would traditionally post to YouTube, we would post them to Dropout and then they would post to YouTube a week later, which is a pretty short window. At the same time as like, we never assumed there would be much of an audience for sketch on subscription. So that window was more like a courtesy to our fans.
Got it.
Like, hey, you deserve this as well as all of your exclusive content.
Okay, sweetener, cherry on top kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But then like on YouTube, you also have the channel membership, which I mean, that's basically like YouTube's paywall or YouTube subscription service of you can have a YouTube channel and then make stuff, you know, some content or different perks available only to people who pay to subscribe to that YouTube channel. So what's the relation then between the YouTube paid channel memberships and Dropout? Like if I'm paying for Dropout, am I not paying for YouTube membership and vice versa?
Yeah. I mean, today they're separate and distinct products, if only because we can't get them talking to each other yet.
Right.
I think YouTube has said they'll allow for that API pretty soon. And then we just have to get YouTube and Vimeo playing nice with each other, which might be tricky.
Good luck.
But that being said, there's very little distinction. The YouTube membership product is all of the same content you'll get on dropout.tv. It's just for folks who don't want to click all the way over to dropout.tv and subscribe that way. I do think like navigation is worse. Experience of viewing the content is worse on YouTube. Considering today, YouTube memberships are really sort of a blog of content, like a long list, and it's harder for us to like create playlists and organize them effectively and stuff like that. It is, however, like in terms of barrier to entry, in terms of friction, you can't imagine less. There's literally a button on the YouTube channel that says subscribe.
Yeah. And how did that subscriber base between Dropout and YouTube compare and contrast?
You mean size-wise?
Size-wise. Yeah, let's start with size.
Yeah, I mean, look, we have a healthy amount of subscribers. For Dropout.
It was, close to 100,000 at the time of when you bought it back in January?
Sure. I'm not going to say precisely, but it's close to that. You know, if we were a Patreon, we would be, I think, close to like the number one Patreon, for instance, in terms of like number of subscribers or number of patrons. You know, the AVOD audience is massive, right? Like we have 30 million followers across social. So does the subscriber number pale in comparison to that? It certainly does. At the same time, as like, I still marvel at the way in which we're getting new subscribers every day. At the same time as like, we're losing some subscribers every day, but we're doing no paid marketing today. We haven't done any paid marketing essentially all year. So all of those users are being funneled through organic, which is kind of remarkable. It's remarkable like how steady that drip is, you know. In terms of demographics, they're pretty much the same. Like the YouTube audience, the College Humor audience in general on AVOD has always broadened as time has gone on. So, you know, when we began producing original content, our core user base, our core viewership base, were all in their early 20s. Now, thanks to YouTube, we skew both a little bit younger in the sense of like 14-year-olds reading 17 magazine. Like, College Humor is kind of an aspirational brand for, hey, look, I can grow up and have fun and be funny. And then also folks who have been with the brand for a long time. So, you know, Outer Edge is probably like 35, although there are certainly, you know, folks older than that watching the channel. We're about 60-40 male, female, which I think surprises some people who would expect that we would be more male. But even over the course of the last like handful of years, we've tried to distance ourselves like even further from that kind of like frat boy image that we, you know, would rather not have. That really doesn't feel like us. We index like highly with LGBTQIA folks. There's a lot of representation on the channels. So I think both on AVOD and on subscription, there's a lot of overlap there. But the core College Humor fan, like the most ravenous fan of us, is probably between the ages of like 20 and 25.
Got it. Okay. With like having Dropout, why continue to sell paying, the YouTube channel memberships, the paying subscriptions on YouTube, as opposed to just pushing everyone to subscribe directly with Dropout?
Yeah. I mean, right now it's just a convenience. Like it's there for folks who would subscribe in a kind of an easier way. There's like one little technical thing, which is I think technically YouTube memberships you can access through PS4 or PS5 now, and we don't have that through Vimeo. So for anyone who wants to watch the content that way, they have that option. But to be like very honest, it's both not that much work and just like a convenience for the audience who wants it.
Got it. Is it something where you're mindful of how many YouTube paying subscribers you have compared to Dropout subscribers, where you don't want to, would you want to get to a point where you have more YouTube paying subscribers? Because then you run into that whole thing of, well, are these really College Humor subscribers or are they YouTube subscribers that you're basically renting each month?
It's a good question. Right now, our YouTube memberships versus our Dropout.tv subscribers like pale in comparison. So it's a non-issue.
Got it.
If they ever were to take on like a meaningful share of the audience, we might have to ask ourselves that question. We're not necessarily known for like answering those questions in a way that's like, for instance, when we saw the writing on the wall and all of our audience started to watch our videos more on YouTube than on our own website, we just went, let's double down on YouTube. Like, we tend to go where the audience is and then reimagine our business accordingly. But yeah, today, not an issue.
But didn't that like eventually kind of, as much as it led to a lot of success for College Humor, led to a lot of problems for College Humor that I would think you would want to avoid now?
Depends on how you look at it. Because like Funny or Die made the other decision. Right. They made the opposite decision. It didn't serve them better than it served us. Like, I always say that, like, you know, certainly social media took a huge chunk out of all of these mid-tier publisher businesses. And, you know, we can talk about like the ethics of that and how it transformed our businesses and so on. But like literally Funny or Die and we were in the exact same position at the exact same time. We made one decision. We went YouTube all the way. Funny or Die said, no, we're going to maintain a video player on our own channel. And neither of us really won, you know? So kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. I think the advantage that we have now is a lot of subscribers and a loyal audience, which, yeah, it can be tricky to monetize, but to the extent we can figure it out, that's a business.
Right. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we'll be right back. And so how are you thinking about like managing, you know, dropout these days where now we have all the Goliaths that have kind of come into the streaming market? And there was, you know, like one of the questions was, okay, when we have Disney Plus and HBO Max, and I mean, next year we're going to have the CBS All Access rebrand of Paramount Plus, plus Discovery Plus, plus, I mean, there's too many pluses, too many pluses. But it seemed like, okay, what does that mean for all the smaller players? And is it something where it's going to be haves and have-nots and it's kind of the Goliaths and no room for anyone else? Or is it going to be Goliaths on one end and the niche folks at the other, and it's the middle that gets squeezed? How are you seeing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think there's no question that the, you know, cord cutting is still happening. Like the unbundling is still happening. There's going to be opportunity for more players to enter this space before like any rebundling occurs, for instance. I will say like Netflix, HBO Max, Disney Plus, like they don't scare me in a sense of like I'm not their competition, right? Arguably, the more truly premium stuff that gets produced by Hollywood for streaming, in other words, the more these services represent the higher echelon of Hollywood, the better it is for us because we're an alternative to that. Queen's Gambit, by the way, I binged the whole thing the last 3 days.
Yeah.
It's like so one good. Of the best things that's been produced in Hollywood, like in years. It's beautiful. What we are is like scrappy, experimental, weird, and there will continue to be a market for that, especially on the internet, which has historically always celebrated those things. And you're right, like how big can a company like ours really be before we're no longer the underdog and like people don't celebrate us in that way? It's a good question.
Right.
But I have no illusions or, you know, interest in trying to be like low rent Netflix. Like I want to be like high rent internet. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think there's a place for that, just as there's a place for really highly specialized SVODs in this market.
Right.
Like, you know, Vimeo OTT supports a lot of them. We've got buds over at Somm TV. You know, Somm is doing all wine-related content, like food and wine-related content. So specialized. But, like, there's a market for that. And, right. You know, Netflix is going to get a piece of that audience with something like Chef's Table, and then they're going to try to go deep and capture the rest of it.
Right. How does that then make you think of, like, how you price Dropout? Because, like, people are probably going to pay for Netflix. If they have kids, they're probably paying for Disney Plus and, like, maybe one or two other of, like, the general services. And then they'll have, like, some portion of their budget for, you know, I fucking love comedy. I'm going to pay for Dropout, too. Or I'm really into horror. I'm going to pay for Shudder. And there's, like, kind of the niche part of it, too. But at some point, it's just like, look, I'm paying for 15 different services. I got to start cutting these. And I'm going to look at the prices.
Yeah, I mean, I think that taboo is kind of going away as time goes on, or it's becoming less as time goes on because more people cancel their cable subscriptions and they go, well, where I was spending like $50, $60, $70 before. Look, I mean, you and I are probably already subscribed to a myriad of these services. I subscribe to Spotify. I have like a, you know, I subscribe to an email, like, you know, Superhuman to make my email awesome. It's like a Gmail skin.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It makes your email great. Like, and I don't have cable. And a lot of these expenses kind of like offset each other where there's like, I have a subscription budget in mind and I'll spend $10 on one thing, $5 on another thing. No big deal. I should also say, I think that like for a niche subscription service, because it's not apples to apples with a Netflix, you can probably afford to charge more if your audience is more passionate. Yeah. And there's a lot of like price sensitivity testing that folks do to get here, yeah. where, you know, they'll realize, just like we realized, price sensitivity is probably less than you think. Like, you could afford to be charging more for your service, even if that makes it just as expensive as Apple TV Plus or Disney Plus, because your fans are that passionate about you, or what you have to offer is so specialized. You know, that being said, I think we are price sensitive with our audience in particular, even though we could probably raise price without losing too many users. A, because our users are young. B, because we're in the middle of a pandemic. And C, because we want our content to be very accessible. So it's a conversation we've had, like, is $5 a month the right amount? You know, couldn't we start to creep higher? Couldn't we do six? Couldn't we do seven and get away with it? We could, but I don't think we'll do it anytime soon.
Do you do only monthly subscriptions, or are there also annual subscriptions where it's lower monthly price if you commit?
Yeah, they're annual too.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much uptake do you get on that versus monthly?
How much? You mean,
like,
how much of the audience?
Yeah, what percentage of subscribers are doing annual versus monthly?
That's a good question. I think it's like 15% or something like that.
It seems pretty healthy.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, I think what Patreon does, what we'd like to do at some point, is start offering tiers. Mm. Because we hear from some of our friends running Patreons that, like, if they're running, say, a $5 a month membership, but tiers on top of that, their average membership starts to drift north of $5 to six, seven, seven and a half. And we hear that Vimeo has that plan for at some point in the future, and that could be material to our business.
Okay. So what would you do for those different tiers? Would it be like, if you pay $2 more a month, you get a free live stream episode that no one else gets access to?
That tends to be the Patreon kind of approach, right? Yeah. Is that, like, depending on how hardcore a fan you are, you might get like a bonus monthly live stream, a little additional piece of content, digital download. Granted, we're big softies when it comes to the audience. We tend to want to offer them like as much as possible for their dropout membership, full stop. So we've even discussed, like, we think we're going to start offering people game changer episodes in the form of keynote presentations that they can download and then play with their friends. And like, it's hard to imagine today, like, charging more for that. We'll probably just do it and hope it generates some positive buzz.
Yeah, because it seems like that would be the foundation of, like, your commerce strategy, or, like, you know, moving into merch beyond, like, you know, branded t-shirts and things like that. But, like, others have, like, cut.com, they do, I forget, they have like this beer pong show on Facebook, but they also like sell it as a, not a board game, but basically a board game.
Yeah, totally. The Cut is super clever at stuff like that. We're actually should be launching our actually Kickstarter at some point in early next year.
So what's same that idea. Be? What are you gonna be?
It's gonna be like a card slash board game. Essentially, I'm actually is like a nerdy trivia game. So we're gonna be packaging it up in the form of like a Trivial Pursuit.
Oh, nice. And with that, do you have to like hire an outside company to be working? Like, do you have, is your eighth employee going to be like a commerce person?
I don't know about that specifically, but we do have a partner on this particular Kickstarter, but we haven't announced anything yet. So that's probably as much as I can say right now.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So Big Breakfast was also part of College Humor. That was basically the offshoot production company. Where do things stand on that front? Is Big Breakfast still technically a part of College Humor? And what are you doing on the TV production side, TV and streaming production side, basically shows licensed to others to distribute?
Yeah. So Big Breakfast technically was sold as we launched Dropout to Propagate.
Okay.
As a part of the Electus sale IAC and Propagate. It's a real Russian nesting doll of company names that's almost laughable. But basically, so I formed Big Breakfast as like TV's or College Humor's like TV arm. Ran it. We did Adam Ruins Everything, Hot Date, Middle of the Night Show, a handful of other shows for, you know, the higher profile, like digital outlets, like YouTube Premium, Facebook Watch. At the time that IAC was deciding to get into the subscription business, they were sort of simultaneously deciding that they weren't really hot on the TV business, that it didn't scale enough for them. And so they sold Electus back to Ben Silverman, who had left it to form Propagate and Big Breakfast as a part of that. So, Adam Ruins Everything, all those properties went with Big Breakfast. And Luke Kelly Klein, who is a member of the Big Breakfast team, went to run it. Super talented guy, Luke, incredibly hardworking. Meanwhile, it kind of like left us to focus on subscription, which makes sense. I mean, I can't imagine doing both without it feeling like somewhat of a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. Now it's like, well, why not, you know, dip our toe back into the TV market? And I think the big why not this year has just been, it's a really hard time to sell TV. You know, buyers are really hedging their bets. They're being like careful about what they do, considering, you know, not only short-term like COVID costs, but also like what are they going to be able to get off the ground long-term. In animation specifically, there's been such a rush into the market that it's like very hard to compete. So, you know, I think we will probably start back up TV at some point. And the big reason why to do that, right? The big reason why I've ever been excited about TV is I want to partner with the talent that I know and love to like continue their careers off digital. But, you know, I think TV also has a lot of downsides. There's a lot of money in it. There's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. It can be a little bit more difficult to like do exactly what you want. And I'm really spoiled. Like College Humor has really spoiled me in that regard. So I can't say I'm itching to do it. Mm-hmm. I think I'll do it if like the right opportunity presents itself.
Got it. Diversity, equity, and inclusion have been, obviously it's been a huge focus this year for every company, as it rightfully should be. But there's also been a lot of attention paid in the entertainment space, you know, both to, you know, to what extent do we have Black actors and actresses appearing on screen, but also like behind the camera, working on shows, and not only, you know, Black culture being represented, but other underrepresented groups being a more part of things, having more of a voice. What are you doing at College Humor? Because you're all relatively diverse. It's obviously a small outfit, but it's not like you're a bunch of just strictly white dudes.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, look, when I was brought into College Humor all the way back in 2006, like, we couldn't have been more male, we couldn't have been more white. And when we started making content, we started making it almost like as a editorial team that had been hired for another purpose. And then started to appear on camera. And I think as time went on, it became sort of brutally obvious that we had an obligation to fix that. So as people churned out, there was an opportunity to invite more, you know, other voices to the table, and not only diverse in terms of race or gender, but diverse in terms of background and experience. Because the thing about comedy, especially, you know, relatable comedy, is if you're going to relate to people, you have to really relate to people, you know, all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. So I think comedy writer rooms really benefit from diversity in that way. So yeah, it's, you know, become a priority, certainly in front of the camera as it relates to representation, And then also behind the camera, just culturally, and making sure that we're providing enough people with enough opportunity. It was something that, like, we were very vocal about in-house and had a lot of, like, very open and active conversations about in, you know, this most recent chapter of College Humor. And it's something that we continue to talk about a lot. Like, how are we going to not only do this, but almost push the envelope here? And is going to be something we continue to do. It's funny, you know, our D&D actual play show, like, we started at imagining that we would be the funny one because there weren't a lot of, like, you know, active, like, comedy D&D shows in the space. And then we instantly got credit for being the diverse one because, you know, we just did what we always do. And, like, we paid attention to the issue of diversity as we were casting it. But it's such a predominantly white male space that we stuck out in that way. Now I think people almost, that's beside the point too. Like, we're just one of the best okay. in terms of actual play shows. And that's where, you know, I think that's what you get. Right. I think that's what you get for being diverse. And I think that's what you get for, you know, holding up the mantle of progress is you get to be known as one of the best.
Right. Yeah. I forget the exact stat, but there was some stat someone I was talking to, I think over the summer, where they were saying something like, you know, the companies with the most diverse, I don't know if it was boards or leadership teams, but are, like, significantly more successful businesses. And that it's, like, a pretty clear correlation between the two.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And we certainly, I don't want to pat ourselves on the back about this too much in the sense that we're such a small team now that, like, as we grow, we have to be particularly mindful of this.
Yeah. How do you do that? Like, what are the resources you're looking to for that? Cause there's always in the past, there's been that excuse of it's so hard to find women directors or to find Black talent. And I think this year, one of the good things this year is it's kind of dispelled that as a valid excuse for anyone to adopt. And it's, you know, a lot of people have come out and said, women of color unite, work with them. They'll be able to help you find folks. And there've been a lot of great initiatives as you're, you know, hiring or working with more people. How are you going about identifying diverse people to be working with?
Yeah. I mean, the nice thing about a priority like this is that it kind of like College Humor became more diverse as it became more diverse. Like, we would hire a diverse assortment of people. Those people would invite more diversity to the table in turn. And they would also, like, champion diversity as an issue. So we were all talking about it more actively. So there's a way in which, like, the solution to the problem also helps to solve, like, to continue to solve the problem where we'll ask our network, you know, for recommendations. You know, I remember talking about this sort of, like, mentorship issue, where if this is a problem that starts, like, way at the beginning of people's careers, how do you put yourself in a position where you're championing people or supporting people such that you'll eventually have the opportunity to work with them once they're more mature? And I think that's another way we try to solve it, where, you know, we form relationships with young people and then eventually they join the team at a higher level. Or you might give someone, you know, an opportunity to come in with less experience who eventually seasons, like, vis-a-vis their employment into someone who's more experienced and can take on more responsibility. So, yeah, I mean, as an employer, you're only ever going to be able to solve this problem by forming relationships early or getting strong recommendations. You know, I think we try to do a little bit of both.
So one thing I want to, you know, talk about production, like, we talked a little bit about remote production, but we're in kind of this funky limbo period right now where there's been something of a return to production. There are movies and TV shows and digital videos and commercials that are shooting in studios and on location right now. But at the same time, we have coronavirus case numbers going up, lockdowns happening, unfortunately. And it's a really tricky time to be going back into production, especially then there are the insurance costs, and you, ultimately you just don't want to put anyone's health at risk. How are you managing production right now? To what extent are you all in physical production, either in studio or on location on shows?
Yeah, we sort of have like three production solutions that we're working with right now. One is animation. The second is like a version of a video podcast. And over time, we've had to work hard to try to like improve the quality of that product. So for instance, we started recording over Zoom. Zoom had certain limitations, so we switched to Skype. We just discovered this new product called Riverside, which allows us to record locally on people's computers and then like upload that to a backend that we can work with, which has been a game changer for us as far as remote recording is concerned. And the third is in-person production, and we're really only doing in-person production for the smallest possible shoots. Those tend to be sketch shoots, meaning they're short form. We're usually working with like a single performer, or at most like two performers. Everyone is, you know, we're following COVID guidelines. Everyone is getting tested in advance of showing up, et cetera, et cetera. We're working with like very, very small crews, like bare bone, you know, three-person crews. Even so, costs go up, you know, with COVID considerations, probably proportionally, right? So they'll go up less for us. They'll go up like monstrously for a typical Hollywood production. I heard somewhere it was like budget times three, or like in some cases
it was only like 15% of budget generally, but maybe it's depend.
Yeah, that could be very out of
movie
date at this point. Yeah. So I think like it's gonna be a while before we're comfortable doing, for instance, like a game show shoot in person again, or something where we have like a large rotating cast coming in and out. But I, you know, I'm like the kind of person who's always inspired a little bit by production limitations. It's kind of like, forgive me for sounding this pretentious, but it's like that thing of like, it's easier to like write rhyming poetry than unrhyming poetry. It's easier to sort of like do creative problem solving when there's a real problem to solve. So yeah, it's not uninspiring to try to work around this issue. I think we're, as a small company, much more inclined to like not take risk, right? So much more inclined to try to find solutions where everybody stays at home and stays safe.
Right.
And are really only going to do in-person shooting if we feel like there's a way to do it with risk completely mitigated.
Got it. With that, though, do you have to be mindful of, okay, is this something that people are still going to be just as interested in watching a year from now? Because, I mean, there was already the fatigue with like the Zoom shows and everyone kind of in a Zoom call and that's the show. And then there's also been the concern of like, okay, if we have shows where there are like COVID storylines, like are people going to actually be wanting to watch that, you know, either now or even a year from now, like once hopefully there's vaccines and we're out of this?
It's a great question. And I think it's like fair, especially as far as Hollywood is concerned. I think we on the internet kind of dealing with a different standard. Like for one thing, it's a little bit more understanding with us in terms of the kind of content we can produce safely right now, because everyone knows our faces. They like care about our welfare. Like okay. I can't imagine they care as much about like Reed Hastings' welfare. Yeah. I'm sure he's a great guy. I've never met him. Also, you know, our content is by its very nature more transitory. Like, you know, we post a video to Facebook or YouTube. In a way, it benefits from being a little timely and of the moment.
Does that also go for Dropout?
I think it goes for Dropout to an extent. I mean, I think we are developing this like big catalog right now of content shot by a video conference. But if we're being honest, like remote Twitch streams were a thing before all this went down, Like, again, the bar is just a little bit lower for us. I think by the time we can get back into the studio and do stuff that's of more traditional production value, there will be a kind of a celebration from the community. Like, oh, thank God I missed this. I know as an audience member, I'm fatiguing of Zoom stuff.
We're
you know, trying to find ways to mitigate that feel fun and interesting with Game Changer specifically. Like, the fact that we were shooting remotely meant we could get some, like, talent to the table who otherwise might have not done the show. So we had Tony Hawk do an episode. We had Giancarlo Esposito do an episode. You know, we're trying to champion ideas and formats that really use the fact that we're shooting remotely as an asset as opposed to a drawback. But yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of ingenuity, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one. And we'll kind of close on this. I know talking, you know, back in late March and April with, you know, folks in the entertainment industry on the, you know, creative side of things, one thing that they were, I think everyone was kind of hoping for is, okay, you put creative people in a box, they're going to find a really interesting way to get out of that box, or they're going to play with that box and it's going to turn into something that's not a box. And basically the idea was, what are the shows or formats that's going to come out of this that we would have never thought to have developed, you know, without something as unfortunately tragic as this pandemic. But I don't know that I've really seen anything beyond, like, the Zoom shows that I don't think is something that people necessarily want to be, like, a long-standing thing. Have you seen anything that's like a new format or take on a show?
God, have I seen something that's really inspiring?
Yeah,
it's a good question. I don't know if I have. Certainly not on, like, mainstream media, you know? This is a cop-out of an answer, but I'll send you a preview of this Game Changer episode that we're doing in 2 weeks, which is kind of a Jeopardy tribute. Basically, what I did is I set up a game of Jeopardy over video conference, and then, unbeknownst to the players, kind of turned it into a game of D&D where the board kind of morphs and changes into, like, an ocean sea that they're navigating over as ships. And they have to, like, confront monsters who appear in the form of, like, illustrations. And I do the voices. And it's the kind of thing that you watch it and you go, like, yeah, this would have been awkward in person. I don't know how you would have done it, you know? And again, not to sound self-aggrandizing, but, like, on the internet, I think, like, the internet kind of takes on a lot of the careers of, like, theater kids, like black box theater kids and people who are used to this sort of, you know, experimental, throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks kind of thing. And I think we have the opportunity on the internet to be creative in a way that, like, Hollywood is just going to have a harder time doing, you know?
Okay. We'll end it there. Sam, thanks so much for taking the time. Really enjoyed speaking with you.
Yeah, man, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tim.
Absolutely. And thank you for listening to the Digiday podcast. Please don't forget to share this episode with someone who you think would enjoy it. You can even rate us on Apple Podcasts if you like. We'll be back next week with another episode.